This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The General Assembly met in special session Wednesday and slapped Charlotte down, overturning the city's controversial LGBT ordinance, and they didn't stop there. Governor McCrory wasted no time in signing that law, overturning his old city's ordinance, while his opponent in the gubernatorial race, Roy Cooper, blames him for helping to put discrimination into law. The town of Matthews becomes another in a series of municipalities in Mecklenburg to consider splitting from CMS. Charlotte City Council is concerned their media room may be bugged. And speaking of bugs, the Hornets are hot. Those and other stories will be the focus of our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here along with Jenna Deary, a reporter for WSSC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Yeah.
Even you, Tom.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Eric with a K, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric with a C, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. That's getting tired, isn't it?
No, okay. I love it. Okay. Keep going.
That was a good guest. I all love right. The breakfast, Mike.
You're welcome. We've all seen the General Assembly try to assert themselves into local affairs before. Asheville comes to mind, Greensboro comes to mind, Charlotte's airport comes to mind. How unusual is it for them to meet in special session to overturn a local ordinance?
Well, this special session, just the way it was called, is itself unusual. Normally, the governor calls special session. He has the power to do that. There's also a clause in the North Carolina Constitution that allows the House and the Senate to call themselves back into session if each body gets 3/5 of their members to approve of that. So just the fact that Governor McCrory originally said, I'm not going to call this special session, and the lawmaker said, okay, we'll do it ourselves, that alone.
Because remember, the regular session starts April 25th, and so the governor's point was that this is unnecessary. It can be handled in the regular short session. But clearly, the Republican majority in the House and Senate thought this is something that needs to be handled now, precisely because the ordinance in Charlotte was going to take effect on April 1st.
And who knows how many, you know, bad things would have happened between the 1st and the 20, you know, what was it,
25th? Yes.
You know.
24 days of mayhem have been averted.
So what you're saying is the General Assembly felt the urgency to meet because they didn't want an April Fool's joke to take effect.
Exactly.
I had also heard that there was something, you know, once it goes into play, it then makes it that much more difficult to
unwind
overturn it. They had, from what, you know, their argument, legal reasons for why they wanted to go through with it before it actually went into
effect. Well, and also, if you're arguing, I mean, remember, their argument is that this imperils public safety. So if you truly believe that, you can't say, well, we're going to let public safety be imperiled for 3 weeks and then we'll, you know, get to it. So I think if you truly believe in what you're saying, you've got to go to a special session.
The problem is there's just not the data much evidence there. That's
no, I understand true. That, but I'm just saying they seem to really believe that, so that's why they carried it out.
One of my favorite facts here, actually, and it was brought up on our air by Tammy Fitzgerald, who's the head of the NC Values Coalition, and she brought up the fact that in Seattle, I believe it was, somewhere in Washington.
Right, it was Seattle with the transvestite.
Yeah, it was, you know, a gentleman went in and was to a female restroom or changing room and was changing, and she brought that up as proof that this is exactly the kind of thing that will happen immediately on April 1st. What she didn't bring up was the fact that he, the person in question in Seattle, was actually on her side, not associated with her, but on her side. He was there to protest the new law. So he was making a scene. The data is just – it's just not there.
Hmm. But the data doesn't seem to affect a lot of people anymore. I mean, empirical evidence seems to be discounted on a regular basis on just about everything if it doesn't fit your point of view.
Right. This is not a rational argument, I think. Go ahead.
And in this particular case, it does seem like this whole issue has just gotten overlaid with a massive dose of election year politics.
Well, you called this, the editorial in The Observer called this one giant taxpayer-funded campaign ad for the GOP.
Yeah, it's kind of hard if you're a veteran observer of politics. It's kind of hard not to see it that way.
After the last election, the national GOP got together to do an autopsy, a postmortem, and they decided that they needed to be more inclusive. And then, yet local Republicans at the state level in Georgia, in Texas, now North Carolina,
Trump,
are taking exact opposite approach.
Well, actually, if you go back to the Mitt Romney autopsy, as they kind of jokingly refer to it, they're also nationally ignoring every plank of that because the election has gone in a different direction. what is fascinating to me, though, is there is a basic tenet of Republican doctrine, which was laid out very clearly by a certain gentleman named Ronald Reagan before he was president, and it laid out the idea that local control is always better. That whether the capital is Washington, D.C., right, or the capital is Raleigh, things are best left on a local level. And starting last year, we really started to see the Republicans in the General Assembly branching out more into local areas, which they have the legal right to do. But the question is this contrary to the core doctrine?
I remember talking to Ruth Samuelson, who was a state representative at the time. I think it was in 2013 when the airport fight began. And I asked her that question because this is a common criticism from Democrats. You're for local government until you're not. And what she simply said was, yes, we are in favor of local government until they're not doing what we think is right, from a state perspective, and it's our responsibility as representatives to go in and correct it. Now, you could take issue with that, but clearly that is the playbook from which they are working.
But when you look at how many have come up through the ranks through local government, I mean, that argument was made on the House floor that many of us lawmakers have come up through city and county commissions. And so who are we to say that we need to strip their power away from them? But, you know, like you said, it goes back. A lot of the sound bites that we kept hearing of why are you doing this is, well, Charlotte just kind of went out a little too far and we got to reel them back in. I don't know if that's effective government.
And this Dan is the Blue rural had urban. This great quote. Senator Dan Blue, who's a Democrat, had this great quote as he was standing on the Senate floor, and he was the only Democrat to speak because, of course, they walked out as soon as he was done. But it was really fascinating to sit there and listen to the minority leader in the North Carolina Senate talking about how they, his party, and he in particular, were the ones who were really for small government. Talk about turning these concepts on their heads.
Right.
Does this make it appear that Republicans talk out of both sides of their mouths on this issue? Because at the national level, they keep saying we're for states' rights, states need to do what they want to do, local control is best.
Well, sure. They've left themselves open to that charge. I mean, you look at the whole argument about how the Republicans in North Carolina have approached the Obamacare issue, for example. You know, Washington, right, stay out of our business. We want to handle, you know, our state or our local matters ourselves. And then, you know, you see
this. That argument was made by Equality NC about, you know, the question that they raised was, is this payback for Amendment 1? Is this payback for, you know, national gay marriage equality? And to say because of how broad in scope this bill was, I mean, that was what seemed to be shocking as you went to look at it, because you thought this was about bathrooms to begin with. And then you see how far this bill went to just strip cities and counties of their power, to take away discrimination protections for that group, and then to go as far as to say we're going to throw in minimum wage in there too and employment discrimination.
Well, I also think this is similar to what we've seen with the voter issue. I mean, remember, much like we don't have statistics to back up the crime wave that follows LGBT ordinances, we don't have statistics to back up voter fraud. And yet, these voter ID laws have passed in state after state. Now, I would say, you know, let's not be too hasty to just say the Republicans do this. Remember, we talk about nonpartisan districts. The Democrats were in charge for, what, a century in this state and did nothing except help themselves, essentially, to the districts that powered them through that period.
Had it not been for the transgender bathroom portion of this local ordinance, would this have gotten the attention of the legislature, and would they have called a special session, and would they have overturned
it? I think what happened is that the legislature, or the Republicans leading the legislature, saw the bathroom issue, the transgender bathroom issue, as the one piece of this whole thing where they felt for certain that most of the general public would be on their side. Generally, when it comes to issues of gay rights and gay marriage, they, I think, understand that the general wave is moving against them culturally and socially. They're increasingly in the minority on that, but they felt like here's an opening, and they rushed in, and I think they got a little greedy while they were in there and just grabbed too many things.
But I wonder if it's about education, because Charlotte was, you know, talking to Equality NC, our ordinance was the first to have the public accommodations portion in it. You had other cities like Greensboro who had already passed their own non-discrimination ordinance, but it didn't go as far as Charlotte's did. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we see all these polls that say most of, you know, North Carolinians or voters here in Charlotte don't want this. I wonder if it's just about education of understanding what it is, because I was just in Orlando last week where they have this in place. And the only reason we thought about it when we were going into bathrooms or, you know, at public facilities, at the beach or whatever, was because we're from Charlotte and we're, right, you know, news reporters and we're, that's on our minds. But other than that, you go into a bathroom and you don't, it's not on your mind of what you could encounter.
The thing that was fascinating to me is they called the special session based on that simple premise that Eric just laid out, which is this is a potential public threat. This is a safety issue. So, you know, I think legislation is often, it's easy to point one side or the other as being a good guy or a bad guy. It's easy to say they're right and, you know, or we're right and they're wrong. But in this case, I would have understood this being a special session bill if it had stuck to the premise of why that special session was called.
Right.
And it was not. I mean, I remember sitting there looking at early drafts of the bill that were being released, and we decided not to to jump and report on those early drafts because it seemed
so broad,
so far-reaching, and these were early drafts. We figure, okay, something – this isn't quite right.
This will be peeled away.
And when it came out, the depth and breadth of change – because of these five pages of quickly done legislation, it's simply stunning. And I want to play one cut here really quick, a little bit of tape that shows you how quickly this argument has morphed. This is from Representative Paul Stamm, who's a Wake County Republican. And I want you to hear how he describes and morphs from this bathroom issue to this broader context of commerce, of all things.
If a person travels to Hickory, they don't expect a different rule in the government facilities of Hickory of who can be in a washroom. They don't want, if they want to bid on a contract in Hickory, they can expect that they can pay their employees according to the law, and there won't be some special deal just for Hickory.
Listen to that. I mean, you literally jump from this base idea of this whole bathroom issue, which is a small part of what the Charlotte ordinance did, but it's the one that got all the headlines, and you immediately jump to other provisions, contracting, minimum wage, as Jenna brought up. There are all kinds of things hidden in these five pages that, you know, the special session cost $42,000 to have this go through. I think the taxpayer cost of this is really going to be measured much higher because lawsuits seem right on the horizon.
Well, interestingly enough, today in the newspaper, corporate reaction to this has been swift. American Airlines, the NBA, the NCAA, I think a lot of sports organizations, the NBA, the NCAA, and ESPN have all said, we're going to take a closer look at this and decide whether or not the All-Star game can be here, whether or not the NCAA tournaments can be here.
Well, remember, Mike, with sports groups, they sports companies, I should say, they are ultra sensitive to consumer sentiment, and we had a Super Bowl that was moved out of Arizona 25 years or so ago because they didn't have the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. For the past 15 years, the NCAA would not do baseball or basketball tournaments in South Carolina because of the Confederate flag. You had a PGA championship that was almost relocated because of a lack of minority members. And remember, the PGA championship is here in 2017. So I think those are real sentiments. The other thing I want to add real quickly as your music cues is that on the flip side, Republicans are saying the certainty of these new rules will actually help business. So we have a point and counterpoint there as well.
And in Atlanta, they're having a similar problem, and the movie industry has threatened to pull all of their business from Georgia to the tune of $1 billion.
Including Disney.
We're coming back in a moment with more on this and many other stories of the week here on our local weekly news roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Iron Yard, using tech-focused education to create growth and mentorship for people and their ideas. Enrollment available for 12-week courses dedicated to teaching code and more in Charlotte. Information at theironyard.com/Charlotte. And Levee Museum presenting Taste of the New South, Savor Sabor, a Latin twist on Southern culture and cuisine, April 14th. More details and tickets at museumofthenewsouth.org. Well, growth is everywhere in Charlotte, and nowhere is it more apparent than in the South Park area. It's been long said that South Park will inevitably become the Buckhead of Charlotte. Of course, Buckhead is the South Park of Atlanta. Just wanted everybody to know that. Built on what was farmland a generation or two ago, it's now booming with hundreds of apartment units going up, office towers going up. Something needs to be done. And the Urban Land Institute was asked to dig into the challenges. We'll talk to them about what they've come up with Monday on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Republicans criticize Obama for his reaction to the Brussels attacks. GOP leaders roll out a plan to stop Trump from winning their party's nomination. And Supreme Court justices appear divided over a birth control mandate.
That's the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, ahead from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Jenna Deary from WSOC-TV, Channel 9, Eyewitness News. That's a long title. Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. We're spending the first part of this program today talking about the special session of the legislature to overturn Charlotte's LGBTQ ordinance. On Wednesday in Indiana, they had a similar rule that went by the wayside. Very quickly, because of pressure.
Because the pressures we were just talking about.
Yeah, well, what you're referring to actually in Indiana was last year in 2015. The Indiana legislature brought up a bill known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and what that would do is allow businesses to refuse service to customers based on the owner of that business's personal religious views. It did a couple more things, but I'm just broadly summarizing it there. We saw a whole lot of businesses protest. I mean, again, the NCAA, you had, a bunch of companies. It was bad enough that Indiana eventually stopped that bill. And Arkansas also did the same because they had a Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was on their books as well. What didn't go as reported is the fact that at the same time, in the North Carolina General Assembly, there was an almost identical bill to Indiana's that had been entered and was due for debate. They tabled that motion then. But in this 5 pages that were passed within 12 hours on Wednesday, the state does something which it had never done before. It establishes its own non-discrimination ordinances, and that includes race, religion, biological sex, gender, and disability, I believe. Yeah. But the definition is so broad when it comes to religion, and because of how it responded and reacted to Charlotte's non-discrimination ordinance, what's really in this bill amounts to a backdoor Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It does the same things mm-hmm. that happened in Indiana and caused backlash that's now being considered in Georgia. It's basically the same. And what's interesting to me, you were talking about the Disney threatening not to film in Georgia. You also have AMC Studios, which produces The Walking Dead, saying if that law is passed, that they will pull out of Georgia. You have a number of companies that are talking here in North Carolina saying they didn't support the NCGA because of the transgender thing. But I think as more people realize that this Religious Freedom Restoration backdoor is in there, there's potential for some more backlash.
Well, Paul Stamm, who we heard from a moment ago from Wake County, said that this law will help the economy of the state while recognizing the privacy rights of every citizen. Senator Buck Newton, who is running for Attorney General, called the General Assembly's action good for business.
I just have to wonder if they really they knew what they the scope of what they were doing. They didn't let everybody else know.
Right.
But they knew. I just have to wonder, did they not understand that they were going to get pretty much the same corporate backlash that states Indiana and those other places have gotten?
I actually think the fact that this bill, the special session itself was unique, but the fact that this bill was not made public until the session began, and literally after the session began, I think about 25 minutes after they gaveled in the House, they opened the only public comment period for this bill. It was in a House Judiciary Committee meeting, and it was a grand total of 30 minutes. So within 30 minutes of speakers. So within the first hour of this legislation being out, you've already gone through the entirety of public comment. I wonder, I have no proof for this, but I wonder if they deliberately did hold this back or did not release it because they knew there would be backlash. And my proof for that, the reason I don't mind saying that is, again, we saw early versions of this bill dating back to March 16th. So they had it for a while. They could have even put it out 24 hours ahead of time. The fact they held it until the gavel hit.
But then the question, though, is why, if they know that they're going to get Google, Apple, PayPal, all these companies coming down?
I think they view that as, in part, public relations, you know, on the part of the companies. And I think they also believe that – I've heard from some Republicans that, you know – while the companies may say this, they're not actually going to stop doing business in a state where the population is growing and, you know, you have all these positive economic factors. And so their thought is the majority of people are with us. There are some loud people who aren't, but, you know,
but
this
see,
is the problem.
See, that's the thing that I find fascinating. You know, I have a little experience with minority groups, being a member of one.
Really?
And it just strikes me that I don't think there's any doubt, in, at least in my mind, that social conservatives are increasingly a minority group. But they do not recognize that fact and do not act or behave as a typical – they are acting as we are the silent majority.
Right.
But they're really the loud minority more so.
Look at what's happening on the national level, though. We're seeing conservatives, you know, if you want to tag them as extreme – voting for a candidate like Donald Trump, who has some extreme ideas on how to lead this country and handle things like immigration reform. And I almost wonder, going back to the political portion of this, if we are in a political season, if this wasn't almost like a maverick move to show we still stand on that side of ultra conservatism with, you know, a crowd, a national conversation around the fact that we're not going to take it anymore. When you view sometimes the LGBT agenda as one that's being forced and forcing us to tolerate
something. This is another example of what's happening within the Republican Party, the dissolution of the Republican Party as we have known it, because establishment Republicans are business people. They are for and favor of business. And I'm wondering what the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce did in conjunction with Mayor Roberts, who's a Democrat, when they talked – they must have talked to businesses saying, we know this is coming down the pike. We've passed this ordinance. What did they say?
It's really interesting to watch the Charlotte Chamber on this one, because they are caught in the middle, and you can tell. Because typically when political things are going on, although they never endorse candidates, they have a statement or you know, a press availability. So this all happens Wednesday. Thursday, the Charlotte Chamber president was on his way to a family vacation. Their lobbyist was also out. But that really doesn't matter. They didn't even issue a statement. And in fact, when they finally did start sending us a response, it was a letter they had sent in February before the council vote. So they still have not responded to what is
– which only says we're
neutral,
are against any form of discrimination, not necessarily addressing the issue.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say real quickly. So essentially what they're doing is just trying to tread water, because remember also the head of the chamber this year, you know, they always have a business person who's the head of the chamber for the year, is Ned Curran, who's a real estate executive who is a McCrory appointee to the State Transportation Board. So they're trying to juggle all these things. And I think that tells you a lot of the difficulty of trying to work with the Republican majority for the chamber
Mike,
right now.
Mike, if I may, the one thing that's interesting too is I don't think – that it simply isn't easy enough for a company to say, we're not going to do business in North Carolina. We're too big. It's too important. You're not going to see major relocations. But what you can see, and this is actually going on right now in Atlanta, and I'm sure this is also what Ned is worried about with everybody else down there. In Atlanta, again, in Georgia, similar bill to this. Governor has yet to sign it. They've already had – the Atlanta Convention and Visitors Bureau has already said publicly, we have 15 conventions that are threatening to not come to the state over the next couple of years if this bill becomes law. 15 conventions that equal $6 billion worth of spending in Atlanta alone. I think what the Visitors Bureau is probably worried about is – let's just try to keep this thing down. Right. Let's see what's going on. Let's plug the holes. Let's not see that go. Because whereas established businesses are not suddenly going to shut down all their ATM sites, tourists, conventions, things like the X Games or the NBA All-Star Game, the fact that the NFL has come out and said, Atlanta, I know you're thinking about bidding for a Super Bowl when your new stadium is built. It's going to be kind of tricky if you pass that law. those are the kinds of things that come in and then flit out that do spend money that can be at risk in a situation.
Attorney General Roy Cooper, who is running for governor, obviously, against Pat McCrory, says the state has put discrimination into law, and he blamed Pat McCrory for this. Both sides see this as a political football. Whose touchdown was this?
I don't know. I think we'll know in November, yeah. But I think the corporate outcry, such as it is already having a political impact. I think you initially saw Cooper kind of on the defensive.
Yeah, he was hands off, right?
Let me
he's
get
never
back.
Come out
and
directly
now,
yet.
But now you see
he did
him,
after this.
He's sending out email after right. email after right. email right. now, basically pointing to the corporations and going, look, Pat McCrory, you're costing us jobs with this
Remember the history that Eric with a C is referring to, which is that the first time Cooper made a public comment on this, he said, well, I think the legislature should be worrying about other things. It was a rather benign rebuke. And then after this passed, he said, discrimination is wrong, period. We're better than this. This is not the way North Carolina should operate. So clearly, it all of a sudden clicked it. Hey, it's campaign time, and this might be.
They had Roy Cooper in a box, and they let him out.
Yes.
Yeah,
it was a strategic blunder.
And Roy Cooper is absolutely taking advantage of this. I mean, this was not his doing, obviously, but the New York Times today in an editorial, like his video statement about this whole thing is right there on their website. Yeah. He is out there with this. And there's another political play here that I thought was really interesting, which is Buck Newton. Senator Buck Newton, who introduced this bill in the Senate, is the one who's been kind of leading the charge. He is obviously running for Attorney
it's
General.
It's Josh Stein.
But the thing that's fascinating to me is yet another provision in this five-page bill. It's amazing you can fit all these things in five pages. Does away with an employee's right to sue an employer for wrongful termination or discrimination in state court.
Yeah.
And that was not an accident, according to what Buck Newton said on the floor. Somebody brought it up. They tried to offer an amendment, and he said, no, this section of the bill is not getting changed.
So where did that come from?
I'm guessing from Buck Newton or somebody along
there. But I mean, why?
It makes it basically forces someone who wants to file a claim for discrimination in firing, it forces them to go to the federal level. And there is a reason that old cliche, you don't have to make a federal case out of this. There's a reason that's a thing, and that's because it is far more difficult, far more expensive and far more your window of filing suit is far shorter. But having to do this with the EEOC, the Equal Employment
Opportunity. But if you go to federal court and win, doesn't that put the kibosh on this kind of thing all over the country?
But the thinking is, these are sort of small fry people who can't afford or don't have the time.
But the ACLU would take your case.
I actually think, and it's just a theory, but I think that people like Buck Newton were thinking when they put that in that was sort of a sop to the corporations. You know, we're going to do all this other stuff you're probably going to hate, but man, are you going to like keeping those trial lawyers off your
back?
That's
interesting.
Matt in Charlotte writes, does the panel think that this will result in Republicans losing a lot of seats in November? And what is the legal outcome going forward? I believe the courts would overturn this law eventually.
Well, possible. I mean, but this is the kind of thing that would have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And right now, they're still in stasis. That means it could turn up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's going to take a lot of time.
I just wonder if it's really going to have that much of an impact on the Republican side because you had so many people. I mean, even if you make the argument for corporations and the loss of revenue and all of that, I don't know that people who wanted this bill to pass and for Charlotte's ordinance to be overturned care about that. All you saw on social media was about your protection and your privacy in the bathroom.
Pat kept
his promise. I don't want a man in a woman's restroom and all of those arguments. I don't think they're paying attention to that.
But I'm curious if
we're sitting here in Charlotte, we're the object of this, and we care. I think there are people in Charlotte who are probably happy that this happened.
Absolutely.
But if you're sitting in a small town in the middle of, name a small town.
Rocky Mountain.
that is not affected by this, that this ordinance was not going to impact.
You don't care.
Do you care at all?
No.
And that's why I make that argument. I don't think it's going, I don't foresee that. And we have to do this thing in television where it's called Man on the Street. You have to go out and get that real person to add into your story and, you know, ask them what they think. And a lot of times you have to explain, sit there explaining because they're not paying attention, and you have to tell them a brief synopsis of what just happened. And I will tell you, 9 times out of 10, when I've gone to do that MOS exercise for my story, I have found somebody who was against the ordinance, who said, I don't think it's right. I don't think it's safe. I hear that time and time again, and that's why I wonder if not going to see it.
Because it's such an easy shorthand, too. That's the other thing, and that's why it's being embraced as a political issue, is if you just say to someone, hey, do you want a man in a woman's restroom with your kids? Most people would be like, no, that's not a good idea. And so that's why you carry the issue forward.
And if they had left it at that, that would have been, I would argue, a clear political win for the GOP in this state. But they went so much further, and now they are being painted, well, I mean, our editorial in today's paper basically equates Pat McCrory with the guys who stood in the schoolhouse door in the South in the 60s.
And who wrote that editorial?
That's a group opinion by our entire editorial board.
The editorial is headlined, McCrory joins a dark list of Southern governors, and you say by signing this bill, he joins the ranks of Wallace, Faubus, and Barnett.
Right. And I mean,
remind us who they are.
I was going to say, for the younger listeners, that's not a good list.
Those were the segregationist governors of the late 1960s who, in some cases, literally stood in the schoolhouse door to keep minority children from attending public schools. And I guess what we were trying to say is that in this instance, you can draw a parallel, a fair parallel, and say that what you're being, you are basically, especially since this law was drafted and written so broadly, to leave out specific protections for gender identity and sexual orientation, you are leaving those folks out and saying, we are not protecting you. You are just, you're on your own, you know. You stand over there and leave it to our goodwill. We will just trust us. We won't discriminate against you. Trust us, which was,
that's essentially what Dan Bishop said.
Yeah.
We have moved beyond the time when we can't be trusted.
Yeah. Well, and remember this.
You trust that statement to be true?
No.
Okay. Remember this. That's the same fight we've had with the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Act. And also, Mike, remember that when we had the protests about this ordinance in Charlotte, a lot of the movement was, and they would bring in African-American ministers and say, look, don't you dare try to compare this to what went on in the 60s. This is completely different. You know, this is...
Well,
this,
you just did. The Observer,
but so. I'm saying that's what's very interesting about how the argument is being positioned from the people...
Well, explain that, Eric.
And the black community is not of one mind on this. You know, there are some... And you saw that there were some African-American Democrats who in the House who voted for these specific reasons. But just to my mind... you know, I just cannot condone, discrimination in any form. But some people can.
The governor tried to distance himself from this for a long time. He even was on television saying this, although he didn't think it was in step with North Carolina values, that it was, quote, probably legal. And yet he signed this in a blink of an eye. When we come back, I want to talk about why you think he didn't wait. He could have waited at least a day or two or three or four or six, because that's when it was going to go into effect 6 days later. He could have waited, but he chose not to. Why and what will the fallout from that be? We'll get answers to that question, and we'll move on to other topics of things that happened this week as the weekly news roundup continues. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting The Miracle Worker, a classic American play, the story of Annie Sullivan, a teacher who awakens the mind and spirit of mute student Helen Keller. Now through April 3rd, tickets at carolinatix.org. Republicans criticize President Obama for his reaction to the Brussels attacks. GOP leaders roll out a plan to stop Donald Trump from winning their party's nomination. and Supreme Court justices appear divided over a birth control mandate. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the weekly National News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. The International Hour follows at 11, and we will continue with our local news roundup with our roundtable of gregarious reporters in just a moment. Stay with us.
Presidential candidates from both parties have criticized the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
We're not going to be able to change everybody's minds, and that's not our goal. It's not what's necessary.
I'm Molly Wood. Passing the TPP through Congress is an uphill battle. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Join Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a lot of things, only one thing so far, but we'll be talking about more things as we go through the weekly news roundup with Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer of the Charlotte Business Journal, Eric Frazier, editorial writer with the Charlotte Observer, Jenna Deary with WSSC-TV, Channel 9 Eyewitness News, and Tom Bullock with WFAE News. I'm going to get the professional announcers in here to say all of that.
You can just say Channel 9.
Oh, can I just say Channel 9?
Just say that.
Okay. For Tom, it's just WF.
Yeah.
WFA. WFAE.
All right, enough of this nonsense. The governor said that he thought that the Charlotte ordinance was out of step with North Carolina values and probably legal, and yet he signed this within hours of the bill going into law. Why did he react, do you think, so quickly?
Well, what was even more interesting there is in the statement they released as to announcing that he had signed the bill, he actually said that a whole lot that's in this bill should have waited for the General Assembly's regular session.
Then why sign it?
He just, again, fell back on what seems to be the easiest talking point. That's the official reason, which is the fear of some kind of public safety issue popping up. But I want to go back to what we were really talking about when it came to the election, whether or not this is a, you know, wonderful ad for Republicans, a wonderful ad for Democrats. For the bases, it's probably not going to change a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But in the middle is the actual somewhat silent majority of North Carolina voters. I think, Jenna, I think you're spot on. When it comes to the House races or the North Carolina Senate seats, you might see some turnover, but likely not all that much. I don't think this is going to endanger a Republican majority at the General Assembly at all. However, when it comes to things like a governor's race, like a U.S. Senate seat, like the Attorney General of North Carolina, I think that is where this will play out. And I don't think we know exactly where those chips are going to fall.
Well,
but Pat
McCrory
was clearly nervous that he wanted to reinforce his base.
Yeah, that's where I – you know, if you followed on social media in particular, he was feeling a lot of pressure. You know, Pat, keep your promise. But then as soon as he signed that bill, I mean, there was just an outpouring from the base of the Republican Party about – he went out and we asked him to do this. We asked him to keep us safe and he did it. And so you're exactly right. This is a shoring up your base. And remember, McCrory is viewed by plenty of Republicans as, you know, does he truly have his conservative credentials? And this was an issue where he could step in and say, see, I did it.
Especially after the whole toll road fiasco. I mean, that was something that has stirred up a lot of animosity towards a big part of his base in Mecklenburg County. And I almost wonder if this wasn't an opportunity politically to come back and say, hey, I'm still the guy that you elected, you know, 4 years ago or whatnot.
Say to whom? The rest of the state or to Charlotte?
Say to his base as we're talking about reinstating that.
Because it seems to me that a lot of people, don't you think he needs this region to be elected?
Yeah.
Because the toll road has gotten him into trouble, and now he's gone against his own city, of which he was the mayor.
Well, he was never going to win Charlotte anyway.
Well, that's it's funny, you know, our dear friend Michael Bitzer, who's on this station a lot, when I asked him about this issue, he said, you know, is there a part of Mecklenburg County that isn't mad at McCrory at this point between the tolls and the ordinance and the airport? But you're right, Mike. I mean, even if you don't think he's going to win, he needs to be very competitive here. And
specifically, he needs to be competitive in North Mecklenburg County.
But you're talking about Charlotte, and we saw a lot of people coming in and commenting on this who aren't living in Charlotte, right? Who live on the outskirts but work here. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this issue might have been a win for those conservatives who are coming in and saying, even though I don't live here, I don't want this ordinance because I have to work here, I have to shop here. My kids come and have tournaments here.
He did win Mecklenburg County in 2012.
Yeah.
He lost it in 2008, and it was a bitter pill for him to swallow. He talked about it a lot after 2008, and then he won it in 2012. So I don't think people in McCrory's campaign look at this and say, oh, Charlotte's just a write-off.
No, but to go back to North Mac, the reason I bring up North Mac is simple. You know, you look at North Mac and Southern Iredell counties, and you look at Robert Brawley's primary run. Now, obviously, Pat McCrory won the primary, but the vote turnout was so high for, you know, Brawley that he basically – McCrory, I'm sure, is a little spooked. So why does he need to reinforce his base at a time when you're moving to a general election and people tend to kind of go more towards the middle? Because he's trying not to lose that.
Mm-hmm. I want to close out this portion of the conversation with a comment from Mayor Roberts, who was on this program yesterday talking about this extensively in the aftermath. And I asked her if she was surprised by this decision on the part of the General Assembly. She said she was, because – she and her colleagues on city council had been talking to legislators in Raleigh.
We had conversations. The most that we heard was that there would be a move to take out the facilities portion, the public accommodations portion. We did not know this would provoke such an overreaching, inclusive of the whole state, and prohibiting things like minimum wage, which had nothing to do with this conversation, just a clear overreach of power. And we did not anticipate this. And I would not knowingly provoke, I will be attacked. I have been attacked. I've had death threats before. I am here for a better future for all. And I am doing what I believe is in the best interests of the city of Charlotte.
You can hear that entire conversation on our website at WFAE.org, yesterday's program. It should be noted that she also said that she tried to talk to Pat McCrory about this issue several times, and he never returned her calls or her text messages.
Oh.
We can't get him to return ours either. We're trying to get him on the show for months. Can't get him to return our calls. Pat, what's wrong?
Heard from him.
Is this the
editorial?
Well, he hates you. Is this the end of this issue, or merely the beginning of the next salvo in the culture wars?
I'm going to go with choice B there. I think that this is not something that's going to die off in a week or two. Whether it is this specific issue or something else that comes up, this is where we are with political debate. And even it being an election year, that may amplify it a little bit, but I just think it's a constant.
I'm going to go a step further. I'm going to say that because of all of the other stuff in this far-ranging bill, it's going to keep – being brought up some form or another, which will continue an arrow pointing at this bill. So whereas the state could have put this whole thing, could have done this, and there's very little recourse, you may or may not see some kind of backlash from business because there are going to be
lawsuits. No state has gone this far. And so we don't know what it's going to look like as far as what's going to happen in the corporate community, what's going to happen to Title IX funding that has that gender equity law where there's a concern of more than $4 billion being at risk. We don't know. So we're going to have to watch. And I agree with you. I think this is going to be a story that evolves.
Okay. So let's on to some lighter fare now. Secession. A few weeks ago.
That's a light.
Fury's back in the race.
Thank you. Sorry. A few weeks ago, the Board of Commissioners for the town of Matthews voted unanimously to pass a resolution demanding neighborhood schools or have CMS face the consequences of a split. Now, other towns in recent memory have floated that idea. Is this just a trial balloon, or are they serious about this? And if they're serious about this, would it even be possible for them to leave and start their old schools?
I would be tempted to say that this is a more of a trial balloon because it's too hard to get this type of thing through the General Assembly in Raleigh, which would have to make it happen. But now that we've seen what happened this week,
look at the relationship anything's possible.
Because a lot of the stuff that's happening to Charlotte from the General Assembly are happening because of people in Matthews who represent them in the Assembly.
It's the suburbs. You're right. Yeah. You're exactly right, Mike. That's where a lot of this is coming from. And remember, we've had Ballantyne. We talked about this before.
They want to secede from the city.
But we've also had the murmurings of what does Lake Norman do because of the toll lane and their frustration. And I think this all is just a clear indication of such a pronounced split. And it's urban-rural, and it's also urban-suburban.
Yep. So given the fact that they would have to work with legislators, and they'd be working with legislators who have already gone after the airport in Charlotte, who were on board for this LGBT ordinance to be overturned, should CMS be listening carefully to
this?
They
should.
Yeah,
yes,
I don't think this is as far-fetched as maybe some people think at first blush.
Yeah, and I think CMS, the school board, is trying to sort of walk this line carefully in terms of, on the one hand, they want to move students around a little bit, but short of, you know, forced busing, the big bugaboo, they want to move the needle on diversity in the schools, but they don't want to move it so far that they get this, you know, panicked reaction in the suburbs where they wind up losing people to charter schools, or you provoke this
type
of reaction.
And you just wrote a recent CMS survey that showed people care a lot more about having a school close to home than they do about having racial or socioeconomic diversity. 82% disapprove of long bus rides to be more diverse.
That is what the survey showed. I've subsequently had people say that they have some questions about how thorough the survey was. And since it was a voluntary online thing, whether or not low-income inner-city neighborhoods were adequately represented in that.
But again, we're having the same argument in a lot of ways as what we just spent the last 40 minutes talking about, which is diversity, equality, discrimination. I mean, all these things, it's a common thing.
Yeah.
Cornelius, Davidson, Huntersville, they've all passed resolutions that every student in their area should be guaranteed a seat in a school close to home. State Senator Jeff Tart from North Mecklenburg County says such a thing is possible. And Bob Ruscio from Southern Mecklenburg County says he would support such a move. Clearly, this is another wrinkle in the student assignment process that the school system is facing. Where are they in that process?
Well, that's a long and winding road that they're on right now. By November is when they want to actually land this thing and have whatever the new policy is going to be, that's when they want to land it. But they're in the process right now of looking for a consultant, I think, who can kind of help them crunch the numbers and actually look at specifics, put some specific plans and policies out there for discussion. Whereas right now we've just had sort of the general, where do we want to go in a general sense?
This is an impossible thing to talk about. It seems to me school board member Eric Davis has said that what this really comes down to is if I like the school assignment that I have, I don't want to change it.
Sure.
Well, how do you fight that?
I think that's absolutely true. And that's why we have these ongoing fights and debates and studies and plans. It just doesn't seem like something that we can ever really reach a broad consensus on.
There is a way now that you didn't see in the past that you can, as a parent, fight. And that's what really scares CMS. And that is you have a lot of options to take your child, your student, elsewhere. You didn't see that in the past. Other times when people have been talking about, should we break up CMS, it was largely because they didn't have a whole lot of choice. You either paid for private school or your kid went to CMS. With the growth of charters, which are a public school, and you can debate whether or not they're a good thing, with the voucher programs, with homeschooling even, there are so many different options now for parents that CMS is even in a tighter situation of they can't just dictate. They really have to try to – I mean, this is a fine line to walk.
As a program note, Charlotte Talks is hosting a special public conversation to talk about school assignment, and you're invited. That'll be Wednesday, April the 6th at 7 p.m. in the McGlowan Theater here at Spirit Square, and you can get information on how to RSVP on our website at WFAE.org. Another school issue. CMS Superintendent Ann Clark has asked the school board to ask the county commission for $805 million bond referendum to cover 29 projects. Evidently, the school board received this proposal counsel from Ann Clark. Enthusiastically, you pointed out at the paper that the only objection came from board member Paul Bailey, who wanted a longer project list and a request for $1 billion. So what's on the list?
There are a number of things on the list, including new facilities, new schools. Their basic argument is that the average voter would say, didn't we just pass one of these things a couple years ago? But the school board's response is, this is the fastest growing, one of the fastest growing counties in the nation, yeah. And we just are not keeping pace. And, you know, it's our job to tell you what the needs are. You guys can vote them up or down, but we have to tell you.
Feel
like that's what they're doing.
Anyone who has children in school can go in that school and point out to you quickly things that have not been repaired or updated in a long time.
How much of the success or failure of this at the county commission level might hinge on the student assignment issue?
That will play into it, because yes. I think in order to sell a bond of that size, you need to have public trust.
Got to have happy customers.
Customers.
Let me put two little puzzle pieces here. Puzzle piece number one, and put these together. Number one, they're talking about coming out with their student assignment in November. And number two, they're talking about holding a bond referendum in November.
Yeah.
So what does that do? Well, it could complicate things coming out of vote.
Very quickly, what is this I hear about the city council being bugged? Evidently,
oh, my goodness.
The media room, evidently. We in the media think that all microphones are always on. At least we tell ourselves that.
Mike, I have too many things going on during the day to keep up with a recording device left in a meeting room. I have to tweet. I have shows I have to be live for. I have video and sound.
So you're saying it's possible that a recorder was left on?
But you're speaking to my pen?
I know. I wish I was that crafty, but I'm not. And I have too much sitting behind my integrity
You're taking the blame for all of the electronic media.
No.
No?
I'm going to put that on my competitors.
But you're saying that it's feasible that a device was left on by mistake or on purpose?
I don't think so. No. I mean, we all might be competition.
Why aren't they asked to take their microphones and cameras out if they're going to go into closed session?
We are.
Oh.
Yeah, we are.
We're required
I think this is a paranoia over council members leaking to media.
Correct.
And turning it around saying, oh, well, the room must be bugged.
And listen, as journalists, if you don't have the characteristic of curiosity, you cannot be a journalist.
Right.
We want to see that, but I don't think we're going to those lengths to get it.
All right, very quickly, because it's spring break time. We're going to get our first – evidently they were wrong about climate change because the oceans are coming. We're getting our first public beach in Mecklenburg County. It's inside Ramsey Creek Park in Cornelius. It's scheduled to open in time for Memorial Day. You've got to park early. There are only 127 car spaces, but the beach will fit 500 swimmers.
Hooray.
Depends on what size they are. Thank you all for the honor.